Syracuse, a city of about 170,000 in upstate New York, is hardly a high-tech mecca. Its largest employers include a Carrier Corporation air conditioner plant and Syracuse University. Prior to the Morris case, the crimes that made the news in Syracuse didn't involve computers. In December of 1989, local citizens were captivated by headlines of serial prostitute murders up the road in Rochester and an in-cold-blood-style murder in nearby Dryden. These came on the heels of the dramatic trial of former Syracuse Mayor Lee Alexander, who was convicted in 1988 of accepting kickbacks. The Robert Morris trial might have played to a more suitable audience in Silicon Valley. On the other hand, Syracuse jurors would be a realistic cross-section of average Americans whose lives had yet to be touched by technology any more directly than by supermarket scanners and digitized directory assistants. Even if the locals weren't riveted by the case, the press turned out in force. Local newspapers had already heralded the start of the hacker trial. Television cameras were stationed outside the building, waiting for the family to appear. Sequestered with relatives in a Syracuse suburb, the Morris family guarded its whereabouts closely. The press showed up because the case tapped America's ambivalent feelings about the power and reach of computers. It had somehow come to symbolize the nation's collective anxiety about computer hackers and the threat they might pose. And the case had a family drama. The father and son, who belonged to a computer science elite, were both obsessed with exploring the subtle intricacies of the complex computers that had come to control much of society. The case also marked the sudden awakening of a national recognition of the fragility of tens of thousands of interconnected computers. The havoc wrought by Morris's program symbolized as never before the nation's increasing dependence on computers and the increasing vulnerability of those computers. As computers became more and more interwoven, each link interconnected and interdependent on hundreds of others, and as these computers became accessible to more and more people, it was inevitable that something like the Morris program would come along. Still, it was a surprise when it came. The two attorneys representing the Justice Department discharged their duties with proficiency. Mark Rash, a short man with sharp, handsome features, who was now the Justice Department's star computer crime prosecutor, wasn't the slightest bit flustered. His command of the complex technology under discussion was so impressive that it gave him an air of extra authority. His partner, Ellen Meltzer, at 37 a Justice Department veteran, was actually senior to Rash, but that wasn't altogether clear in the courtroom. Meltzer deferred to Rash on most technical points. Even before the trial opened, Rash and Meltzer filed a motion asking the judge to dismiss as irrelevant any evidence involving Morris's intent. The evidence of lack of intent to cause loss is simply not relevant to any issue in this case, Rash declared in his motion. According to the law, Rash said, the prosecution needed only prove that Morris intended to break in and that damage resulted from the worm, not that Morris intended to cause damage. Jury selection went swiftly enough. Both the prosecution and the defense were looking for one important criterion. None of the jurors should have so much as a fleeting knowledge of computers. All prospective jurors were asked if they owned a personal computer, if they knew anything about computers. I don't know a thing, replied one woman, and she was promptly seated on the panel. Only three prospective jurors owned computers, and all three were rejected by either the prosecution or the defense. One man who knew nothing about computers himself, but whose son worked at IBM, was excused. In the end, two women who used computers in their jobs as clerks were seated on the panel.